Chapter 10. The Beast in Me. The first signs of a disturbance in Cash's otherwise placid new life came when he stopped attending Evangel Temple in 1977. The reasons he left are unclear, but he continued to grow uneasy with the way his celebrity status affected the church. Tourists came by to catch a glimpse of him, and the church had to post signs forbidding photography inside the building. "We even had one guy who went to the altar to become a Christian," says Jimmy Snow. "John came up and knelt down and was actually praying with a man when the guy turned around and started to pitch him some songs. I couldn't believe it." John handled it very well. Now that he was ordained, Cash thought that the solution was to start his own church meeting at the House of Cash. But after a few months, he faced similar problems there. "People came in flashing cameras," says Dr. Bill Hammond. "He felt so grieved because he thought it was dishonoring to God. He had a hard time going to any church without people taking advantage of him, so he closed the services down." After that, he attended Hendersonville Church of God, pastored by John Cobaugh, who baptized John Carter Cash in the Jordan River when he was 9. Cobaugh also baptized Cash in the river that day, which was his 3rd baptism. But his attendance there came to an end after about a year and a half, and he found himself again without a spiritual home. Although he struggled to remain involved in church, the discipline had helped stabilize his spiritual life. Belonging to a group and being accountable to a minister kept a check on his excesses, whereas solitary meditation in the woods involved no such responsibility. Organized Bible study at church was thorough and systematic rather than cursory and random. He acknowledged this when he was at Evangel Temple, saying, "My policy of aloneness and severed fellowship from other committed Christians would weaken me spiritually. Jesus never meant for us to try and make it on our own. Missing it would leave me vulnerable and easy prey for all the temptations and destructive vices that the backstage of the entertainment world has to offer." In his 2nd autobiography, Cash remembered the early 1980s as the start of his drug relapse. But Marshall Grant says it began earlier, coinciding with the cooling of this intense evangelical period. Besides slowing record sales, there didn't appear to be any obvious triggers. He just started to scrounge pills from musicians he met on the road and was soon just as addicted as he had been in the mid-1960s. "If anything, it was twice as bad after he got back on in the late 1970s," says Marshall. "He would have been dead on more than one occasion if I hadn't have found him." Oddly enough, as this new decline set in, Cash developed a passion to write about the Apostle Paul. His final course at Christian International School of Theology on the life of Paul had captured his imagination. Undoubtedly, he saw himself in the story of this passionate Jew who persecuted Christians before undergoing a profound spiritual transformation while traveling the road to Damascus. Initially, Cash envisioned a film, The Reborn Man, and then that idea changed into an idea for a novel, The Gospel Ship. Describing the apostle to country music people, he said Paul was a man who suffered and hurt, but who was also highly spiritual. A man who had the strength of body and the power of will to overcome every obstacle in his path in order to accomplish his desired mission. He was always looking for new ground to cover and new places to go. It sounded uncannily like a description of Johnny Cash. Ironically, just as he began to explore the life of the man who recorded New Testament theology, Cash was almost always too stoned to put his own ideas on paper in a cohesive way. He read books, studied the Bible, and he even sought the wisdom of Bible scholars and the knowledge of historians, but he couldn't focus his mind long enough to create a narrative flow. Embarrassingly for Cash, Billy Graham would sometimes announce from the podium in front of mass audiences that his good friend Johnny Cash was writing a book about the Apostle Paul and that he expected it to be one of the best books on the Apostle. On August 16, 1977, Elvis Presley died of a heart attack at his home in Memphis. At 42, he was only 3 years younger than Cash. His bloodstream contained a cocktail of 11 drugs. Hearing of the death, Cash issued a formal statement. "June and I loved and admired Elvis Presley. We joined his family, friends, and loved ones in mourning his death. He was the king of us all in country, rock, folk, and rhythm and blues. I never knew an entertainer who had his personal magnetism and charisma. The women loved him, and the men couldn't help watching him. His presence filled every room he walked in. He, of course, will never be forgotten, and his influence will always be felt and reflected in the music world." For someone whose career had started alongside that of Elvis's and who had shared a manager, producer, friends, dressing rooms, and stages with him, Cash seemed oddly detached. According to Marshall Grant, this was partly due to the fact that Cash was back on the pills himself and incapable of deep emotional feelings. It was also partly due to the fact that the two men had never had a close friendship. They last met in Hollywood in May 1960 when Elvis was filming G.I. Blues on the Paramount lot and Cash was living in Encino. Richard McGimony, the songwriter who put up Cash's bond when he was arrested in Lafayette, Georgia, recalls Elvis being in Nashville in the 1970s and wanting to see the house in Old Hickory Lake, but Cash deliberately avoided him. "He just took off with me," he says. "He told me that Elvis and his goons were coming over, but that he didn't want a whole lot of people hanging around." The rivalry that had started in 1954 when Elvis cut his first record with Sun had continued through the years. Freddie Beinstock managed the music publishing company Hill & Range. Not only did the company have a British publishing deal with Cash, but Beinstock also collected songs for Elvis Presley, whose companies Elvis Presley Music and Gladys Music were held by Hill & Range. The one thing that Beinstock recalls about his meetings with Cash is his curiosity about Elvis and his success. "I think that to some extent he resented my relationship with Elvis," he says. "Even though Johnny wrote most of his own songs, he always thought I was giving the best songs to Elvis." Drugs dulled Cash's conscience. He engaged in his most excessive behavior only when drunk or high. When asked to explain his fall from grace in the 1970s after telling the world that he'd cleaned up, he said, "I never lost my faith during that time, but I lost my contact with God because anyone on drugs or alcohol chronically becomes very selfish. You don't think about anyone else. You think about yourself and where your next stash is coming from or your next drink. I wasted a lot of time and energy. I mean, we're not talking just days, but months and years." In the summer of 1978, Mother Maybelle's health deteriorated sharply. She had problems with her thyroid, circulation, and bladder, and the doctors predicted that she wouldn't outlive the year. They were right. She went to bed on the night of October 22nd after playing a game of bingo and watching a rerun of Bonanza on TV, and didn't wake up. Cash had lost not only his mother-in-law and musical colleague, but his fishing buddy and one of his most dear friends. 3 months later, she was followed in death by Sarah Carter, the last living member of the original Carter family, thus closing a great chapter in the history of American music. In December 1978, he and June took part in the Billy Graham Christmas special, and in March and June of 1979, he appeared at Billy Graham Crusades in Tampa and Nashville. In December 1979, he released the gospel double album, A Believer Sings the Truth, which contained the last recordings he had done with Jan Howard. Columbia chose to celebrate Cash's silver show business anniversary in 1979, although it had actually been only 24 years since his first release on Sun. His recording career was clearly flagging, and his music had become formulaic and uninspiring. He had made his name with the boom chicka boom sound and seemed afraid to move too far from it, lest he lose his distinction. Columbia decided to put him in the studio with Brian Ahern, a Canadian producer who had built his reputation working with Emmylou Harris and who had a sharp ear for delicate sounds. The resulting album, Silver, turned out to be one of Cash's better recordings. His voice had a fresh clarity, and there was a vibrant quality to Ahern's instrumentation. In addition to the familiar guitars, bass, and drums, there were flourishes of fiddle, banjo, trumpet, and even flugelhorn. Silver was the last Cash album that featured Marshall Grant. By early 1980, he had been fired from the band that he had helped form in 1954 as a 26-year-old mechanic. Though Cash fired off the bitter letter that formally terminated the partnership, Marshall shared the feeling that things were at an inevitable end. Cash had his reasons for releasing Marshall. Wanting to grow musically, he thought that Marshall's style of playing was restrictive. He also decided that Marshall had become too controlling. He became suspicious that Marshall was not acting solely in Cash's best interests and had become alarmed by the power Marshall wielded, taking on the responsibilities of a tour manager. As he slipped back into his drug habit, Cash probably also resented Marshall's attempts to restrict his pill popping. Marshall had absolute disdain for drug abuse and little sympathy for those who partook. For him, it was a simple question of restraint. "There was no excuse for it," he says. "I'm 75 years old and I've never tasted a drop of alcohol. I've been in the business 50 years, and that's the proof that you can do it if you have the fortitude. If you want to make something of yourself and come back to your family, then that's what you've got to do. It's a matter of self-control. That's all it is. That applies to everybody.